So we're now open for questions and answers.
Yeah. So the daily payments are mostly done in cash or through mobile money, like M-Pesa. Yeah. Yeah. So definitely the fact that the co-op makes a direct deposit into the bank helps. So that's one element of the frequency of payments that matters. But to some extent, the second experiment also shows that the fact that the money is withheld, so the commitment component also plays a role. So it's not just the transaction cost side, but also this commitment component.
I just wanted to make sure I understood. So it does influence the preference if the daily payments are made by mobile, because the money isn't available and it needs to be saved. But there's still a strong preference for the frequency.
Exactly.
Thank you.
This is a question that came up during Rocco's presentation. So perhaps Rocco will want to chime in, but you can chime in as well. Kind of a stark question about private service providers. If cooperatives are struggling, why not simply put the emphasis on private service providers? If a cooperative collapses, won't the private service providers take over?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's perfectly fine. And in fact, in the specific sector from which the figure were coming, so the Rwanda coffee, it is indeed the case that a lot of the struggling cooperative have been, the mills owned by a lot of the struggling cooperatives have been kind of rented out by private sector providers. So it's totally fine. I guess the market, in a way, sort of, you know, allow, and the heterogeneity figure show that there are also some co-op that do well, and that there are some co-op that do not do very well. And then the question is, you know, one way to improve the working of a co-op is indeed for private guys to come in, and you know, if they are better managers. Another way is to try to improve the performance of the co-op. In some of these agricultural chain, I mean, again, it depends on context. I think that the concern is that the cooperative might be, all else equal, in a better position to maximize the welfare of the farmers, because monopolistic downstream processors, instead, they might, you know, have slightly different incentives. So there might be an argument for why well-functioning co-ops might be preferred. But hey, if the co-op is not functioning well, it's totally fine for private guys to step in. I think, I mean, at least that's my view. There are, I think, bad reason why sometimes cooperatives are kind of helped or subsidized, and that's because they give a lot of political control to the, and, you know, these, I think, are not the good reasons to help the co-ops, but there might be very good reasons to help co-ops, and some which I've mentioned before. I don't know whether that answers your question.
No, I mean, I guess the thing I would add to what Rocco has said, and I think what came out from his research is, you know, the fact that in this particular industry, there's a mix. So it's a combination. And we talked about the nature of competition, even looking at the dairy industry. I mean, farmers have options in these cases. And so they're making different choices, and that's okay. Farmers have a choice. Some are belonging to cooperatives. They see value of doing that. Some are selling to private dairy. Some are selling directly to traders. So we're seeing various different models working and being applied. But what we're trying to show is that, you know, there's some reasons possibly behind what's driving this. And so understanding that, how does that help us in working with these types of organizations and in working with farmers and farmers groups?
Yes, and just to reiterate, just to remake the point that, yeah, what that particular context Rwanda showed was that the best performing cooperatives perform better than the best performing private firms. So a well-run cooperative might be at an advantage, maybe precisely because it established a stronger partnership with the farmer.
As the woman said in the quote, making sure that there is a future market for the product is important as well. So did your study look at those types of things?
Not explicitly in these studies that were presented, but obviously we completely agree that historically the marketing role of the co-ops has been, and today is still very important. Though I think that in understanding the relevance of, at least for the Kenya dairy sector, one also has to take into account that the sector is probably more competitive than it used to be. And so maybe this marketing role does not necessarily play such a strong role as 10 or 15 years ago. But it's not something that we address directly
We didn't directly ask the question either, but I think it's an interesting nuance to the access to market piece and some reasons behind that. I think intuitively that, I think anecdotally, that's what we're seeing. And maybe there's an opportunity to dive into that a little bit more. So it's a very good point. Thank you.
All right, we have another question from online. A question from Stephen Mink, who says, in numerous countries such as Indonesia, Vietnam, and Cambodia, true farm member-driven co-ops are struggling to emerge from long periods of political meddling by political processes. And trust has to do with overcoming the resulting memories of farmers that political forces have distorted many decisions in the cooperatives. Your research base does not really speak to this context, but do you have any observations on countries that have done a better job of transitioning from periods of such political interference in cooperative governments to a healthier, member-accountable cooperative leadership?
That's a question that we could spend a whole separate ag sector council on, so thanks for raising it. I'll just speak from our experience working with in the dairy sector in Kenya, for example, and I think one of the interesting things about the cooperatives we've been working with is that they've been around for a very long time. So I talked about the average tenure of membership, that these cooperatives have gone through a number of different iterations over decades of time. And so one of the important things that we've worked with them on is recognizing how to overcome these challenges, because these challenges of political interference are not unique to the developing world. We've gone through them on our own soil as cooperatives have evolved. And so the confidence to be able to directly address those, to be able to advocate, is really crucial. And in many cases, they've done this. I think I pulled up a quote from one of the co-op farmers in the focus group talking about how they actually exited the cooperative because of some of the governance and leadership challenges, and then yet remained and came back. And so there's examples of where a dedicated membership, one that has some governance structure, can help overcome some of the different challenges they face.
This is not something that we have addressed directly in the research, but I think that in terms of future research endeavors, it would be very important to map and to collect data on political power turnover within the co-ops. To which extent do we see management changing? To which extent do we see board members changing? Do members expect that them or somebody else in their family could take a lead role in the co-ops in a few years? We did a bit of this preliminary data collection in our survey, though it wasn't the focus. But I think that especially as one moves toward a more comparative approach where many data from many different organizations are collected, these are data that should be prioritized to quantify this phenomenon. And maybe Rocco has done more in this round of stuff, I don't know.
I'll just chip in a couple of thoughts on Stephen's question. First of all, I agree, this is a key question, and I think it's a very important one. And there is some work in the context of done in the context of Indian sugar cooperatives that suggests that inequality in land holdings seems to correlate with among farmers seems to correlate with poorer performance of the cooperative. And this is basically because if you have a cooperative that is dominated by a few large farmers, those guys might end up having an easier time, essentially, in diverting resources away from the cooperatives towards their private benefit. And, this can happen paradoxically through the provision of services that benefit disproportionately larger farmers. Okay, so this, I think, puts to the extent that sort of some of historical legacy maps into this inequality, I think that could be a determinant. But then again, I think the context of Rwanda is a promising one to look at, because I mentioned that we see a big variation across cooperatives in their performance. And obviously, the recent history of Rwanda is a you know it has been tarred by very negative events that have potentially had very negative consequences on the general level of trust and the level of trust on in those that hold power at the local level. And yet, we see that in that environment, some cooperatives are really thriving and doing very well now. Maybe this is just a, you know, in the micro, an illustration of the, you know, kind of the broader transformation that is happening in that country. But it does also suggest that there might be scope for overcoming very negative legacies. But I wouldn't know how that can be achieved or, you know, who has achieved it and how the people that has achieved it are different from those who didn't. So I think it's a great question.
And we have another in-room question.
Is there any correlation between the size of the farmers in terms of the amount of the milk delivered and who sell their milk to the cooperative and to the primary traders? There is any correlation between that?
Yeah. So that's something we look at in one of the surveys. We collected a random sample of farmers, regardless of, you know, who they were selling to. And from that, we see that in our setting in Kiambu in central Kenya, farmers that are selling to the co-op are slightly larger. These are all very small farmers. So the number of cows is between 1 and 3. And I think farmers selling to the co-op are something like 2.7 versus 2.3 cows. So small but significant difference. Now, we don't have evidence for that, but that's consistent with the fact that if the co-op's payments help to save, you will build up your stock of cows. Obviously, I don't have any direct evidence to validate, but it's an hypothesis.
All right, this is a question from Yanisa Tedese Gebreselassie. Quite a mouthful, I hope I pronounced that correctly. Who asks for some concrete suggestions on how cooperative management members can build strong relationships with cooperatives in addition to creating common understanding of the purpose of the cooperative. Is that a broad question, or is that one that you can address?
No, I think it's an important one, and I think it falls under, in my view, it falls under the trust equation. And so, you know, that's multidimensional, but as I think about it, you know, it's two ways. So one is cooperatives creating a mechanism to listen and to hear member grievances. And so what we've seen is that that's easy when you're a smaller organization. Maybe you're a co-op with 50 people. If you're the manager or the leader of that cooperative, it's easy for you to hear those voices. When you become large, integrated, thousands of members, it becomes tough. I've seen situations in other countries where there's a line of 100 farmers waiting to talk to the chairman of the cooperative, of the board, right? And so figuring out a management structure to deal with those grievances and also listen is critically important. And then likewise, the flip side of that is communicating out the purpose and vision of the cooperative and having common agreement and alignment. And we saw examples, and perhaps Lorenzo and Rocco can comment more on this experiment about the bylaw changes and how that was disseminated to the cooperative in two different ways. And so they did some interesting research comparing those two ways. So it's two, you know, I see it both as a listening mechanism and also as getting information out to the membership.
I have a very broad, big picture question. It doesn't directly correlate to your research, but I'm just curious. A lot of us on the implementation side are tasked with very concrete indicators on capacity building of farmer-based organizations and co-ops. How can we pitch or convince donors that it's important to also measure feelings of trust and loyalty and how that can be an indicator of success?
What you focused on is critically important. And it's something that I wish we could convince those responsible to look at the types of indicators that are correlated with the long-term success rather than the short-term performance of these types of institutions. Our office separately is working with a program called Local Works, and we are going to be proposing indicators, or using indicators actually, that are quite different than the norm. We'll be looking at something very similar to this research. We'll be looking at the net promoter score of organizations that serve constituents. We'll be looking at any movement in the hubs of networks from external to internal resources. And we'll be looking at changes in social capital indices over time. But we have the luxury of about a 10-year program, so it's something that these types of measures can be defended. But I think really the responsibility for this type of change rests in the people in this room and the people on the webinar. And that is trying to explain to and convince decision makers within this agency and the broader development community that there are measures that are far more significant than the ones we use, and ones that basically do correlate strongly with the long-term success of these types of institutions.
If I can add briefly, I also think that for some reason there is it's always perceived that collecting information indicators like trust, relationship, and social capital is prohibitively costly or too hard, while I think that social scientists have developed and tested by now modules that are pretty standard, decently easy to implement. It's not a perfect measurement, but it's a starting point. We've seen some examples in the work today. So you shouldn't think of collecting trust as something that is going to take one day per farmer.
All right, just a couple of quick clarifying questions about the research in Kenya. One was, what criteria did you use to choose the farmers for the study? And also a clarification about what percentage of the beneficiary pool were members versus non-members in the dairy cooperatives in Kenya?
So there were multiple studies discussed throughout the presentation. So the first one was the impact of the restating of the bylaws on deliveries, the one that Rocco talked about, and there we used the entire population to see how targeted member responded after the meeting versus non-targeted member that were members that were already selling all of their milk. Then for our studies, we had a random sample. We're basically random samples, and depending on the specific component, it was random sample of all the members for the experiments, random sample of the members selling both to the co-op and to the traders for some of the survey questions. And then for the brief survey in which we compared members and non-members, it was just a random sample of the farmers in the areas. Okay, and then there's some technicalities in some attrition for some of the studies, but the details are in the papers that I think are linked in the.
Well, since we're toward the end of the session, I won't wrap up with many words. Only to first thank the presenters. I've worked with co-ops since 1975, and I learned quite a bit today. I thank them for that, and I think this type of presentation, the importance of not acting in terms of what we think is the case, but actually using research to inform what we do. And I personally would like to express my appreciation to Greg, Lorenzo, and Rocco for a really fine piece of research and for sharing it with us. I'd like to also thank those of you who came this morning, as well as the 70-odd, I hope they're not really odd, but the 70 participants on the webinar. For taking their time and sharing their questions. All the post-event products will be posted on AgriLinks. We hope that you will use AgriLinks frequently and contribute and benefit from it. I'd like to again thank the participants, the speakers, and particularly the Bureau for Food Security and AgriLinks for making this event possible. Thanks very much.